warm welcome to this podcast episode on the art of authentic leadership communication, from noise to resonance. This podcast is brought to you by the International Academy of Leadership, known by its German acronym as the IAF. Based in the town of Kummersbach near Cologne, the Academy develops leaders working for partner organizations of the Friedrich Naumann Foundation for Freedom from all over the world, bringing together experts, opinion leaders, committed young liberals, and aspiring leaders to share specific experiences and knowledge and to develop themselves and their organizations while exploring liberal solutions and responses to public policy challenges. My name is Marike Groenewald, and in today's episode, we are exploring the leadership consequences of a world in which the loudest voices often dominate. How can leaders communicate in a way that truly resonates with the people they're trying to reach? How can leaders craft messages that are not only compelling, but also authentic and aligned with their values? From navigating high-pressure environments to amplifying their impact without losing their integrity, this conversation dives into the challenges and opportunities of leadership communication today. I'm excited to be joined by my dear colleague and friend, Clinton de Prier, as a co-host in today's conversation. Hello, Clinton.
Hello, Marike. Hello, everybody. It's a joy to be here with you in this conversation today. As Marike said, we are excited to be joined by Pamela Hart. Pamela is the founder of Release Your Voice, and she did so already in 2008. So with more than about 20 years of international public speaking experience, Pam really knows what it takes to break free from anxiety and how to engage the audience in an authentic way. Pamela has a graduate degree from Harvard University and also a bachelor's degree from the University of Missouri-St. Louis in psychology and nonverbal behavior. She also teaches in the public relations and writing program at Simon Fraser University. Hello, Pam. Welcome, welcome.
Hello. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to see both of you, and it's a pleasure to be here with your audience. And I am so excited to be talking about some of these ideas, these concepts, and what we can do to be more effective communicators in this very challenging communication time. Mm-hmm. So thank you for having me.
Fantastic. And thank you for making time, Pam. Let's just start from the beginning and maybe hear a little bit about your story, how you ended up where you are now. Because I think every leader's voice has that story. And we speak from our story as well. And behind those who teach others how to lead with that story, I think there's also a story of personal growth, of discovery and purpose. So what is your story of discovery and purpose of this mission to help leaders communicate authentically and compellingly? And maybe how has that journey taken shape over the years?
Wow, thank you so much for that.
In a nutshell.
Well, the wonderful thing is that when you get to a certain age, you realize that you have a certain amount of experience and knowledge based on that age, but it also makes your story sometimes a little bit longer. So I'm going to have to try and shorten this up a little bit. So I've always been interested in how people work biologically, psychologically, and how this always affects and impacts communication. So my journey started out basically with me having an undergraduate degree in psychology, biology, nonverbal behavior, and watching and seeing how people interacted, watching how they responded to stress, how they responded to certain stimulus, such as being in a media interview or being in a high-stakes job situation. And all those things were really fascinating to me about how the body worked and how the mind and body worked together. And then I was really drawn also to the theater. Actually, I was drawn to the theater, and I liked being on stage. I liked speaking in front of a group. And I felt like I could somehow put these three things together. And so I was able to get my undergraduate in psychology, biology, nonverbal, and then my graduate degree in communications, and in specifically in the study of language and how to communicate to large audiences. So I combined those two. And when I finished at Harvard, I wasn't sure where I wanted to go, what I was going to do with all this. And I moved to New York and lived in New York for a while. And after I was in New York for a while, I decided that I wanted to move and change my life. And I ended up moving to Canada. And there I started to work with different political parties and train political leaders, which seems like such a stretch from where I started. But actually, I started working with a political party here, one of the political party leaders for the NDP. And suddenly, I was teaching MPs, politicians, how to speak, how to take those tools that I knew and apply them to the political arena. And that's when I started my company in 2008. And subsequently started to apply these concepts around the world in both the business world and in the political arena. And now it's many, many, many years later, and I've seen a lot of changes in the way we have to communicate. And I think that like myself, like everyone, we have a journey in life. And we don't know where that journey is necessarily always going to take us, but we end up in a place. And I'm in the place where I am right now in my journey. And I also want people to think about in their communication journey, in their political world, in their arena there, it's a journey. You know, if you deal with suffer from fear or anxiety, or if you don't feel as though you're great at it, or you're not sure how to create your messages, remember, you're on a journey. And the journey will flow, and it will, as long as you know what your goal is and where you want to be and what your intention is, we all have a journey. So that was my journey, and everyone's journey is different. So I really encourage people to recognize that you may not be what you perceive as the perfect communicator right now. However, I don't think that I was as good a communicator in 2008 as I am today. Because I know a lot more and I have a lot more experience. So,
I can also imagine, I mean, 2008 was roughly the time when social media started kind of taking over. And I would imagine that over this journey that you're speaking about, you've seen a lot of change in terms of what people value in communication, but perhaps more so in political communication. Having worked with political leaders, helping them speak with confidence and authenticity in front of a large group of people, or perhaps just a large audience on whatever medium that is. And so I always have such immense empathy for political leaders today who have to walk this incredibly tight line between being yourself authentically while at the same time being under such immense public scrutiny for everything you do. It's not just your professional life. It's your personal life. It's your family. And it's their lives as well that are often under the spotlight. And so this tightrope between authenticity, being yourself, but also wanting some privacy, I suppose, comes also at the same time when there's a lot of mistrust in the media. There's a lot of questioning about, can we really trust what we see online with AI tools getting so incredibly advanced? And so it places an immense, I would say, an immense premium on authenticity in the current year that we find ourselves in. So how would you encourage or help political leaders think about authenticity in the way that they currently speak it? So staying true to themselves while also reaching their audience under this intense scrutiny. Does that make sense? That's a very long question.
It is a long question, but it's a very complex situation, and consequently, the question is complex. So I do believe that it is much harder to do and walk that tightrope today than it was 20 years ago. I know it was. It is. So the question is, first, we need to understand what is it that we're seeing and what's the change? And then how do we respond to that change? And how do we have, and then how do we protect ourselves and still maintain some sense of our own personal life? So the first step, which is understanding what's happened and what's the difference now. So values and authenticity are being demonstrated in a different way than they were pre-social media. They are now being demonstrated in what we call a very performative sort of way, whereas people, what we used to call it, making sure that you had a good picture if you were going out and campaigning, or you were around, if you were campaigning with workers, you were around workers. But it's gotten to be much more than that now. That was always when you got to make sure you got a good, you know, good photo op. Now it's more about not just that photo op, but performance of it, performance of what we see as values. And, you know, I'll give you an example that I think is really striking. During the time that Britain was thinking about, the UK was thinking about leaving, or when they were talking about leaving the EU, there was one particular leader. His name was Nigel. I'll just say his name was Nigel Farage. And he was talking about the values of the British people and the UK. And he didn't just go out and talk about values or go on television shows or radio shows or just post things on social media. What he did was, is he did something that was very much more performative. He would go out and he would go out to pubs. And he would go to a pub and he would go there and he'd have a pint. And he'd have a pint and he'd be talking about the pints and the joy of a British pint and the joy of being in Britain and the sheer wonderfulness of their own culture and their values. This pint of beer, which is basically, he didn't really give any particular specific claims or have any particular facts. What he had was an illustration saying, here I am, I'm with the British people, I'm showing that I care about what we care about, what you care about. And it wasn't just a photo op, it wasn't just a picture. It was something where he was there, he was participating, and this kind of engagement. And that's what we're seeing a lot more of these days, which is, that's the next step, which is the kind of engagement that you do, understanding that values and authenticity are going to be seen now as something where you are out there with the people, you are more performative as opposed to more media interviews and things like that. So really need to be thinking about who is that audience, and we're going to come back to this again and again and again today. Who is that audience? Where do your values lie? And where do their values lie? What's the meeting of the two? And how do they align? And then how do you illustrate that in a very visual and also a communicative grassroots way where you are out there with people? Now, I will give you an example of this, which it's quite astounding to me. We've just seen this in the 2024 election in the United States with Donald Trump. If you compare Donald Trump's this rally sort of situation with Harris's rally situation, I don't know that they would really be called the same thing, but for lack of a better word, that's what I'll call them. Whereas Harris stayed very much on target. And I'm not saying which is perfect. I'm telling you about the researches and what we're seeing and what you need to be thinking about. As we are on this journey, we're learning more and more. Harris was very much traditional It was the traditional, hey, here's my stump speech. Here's what I got to say. Here's what are my key messages. It's something that I've always pushed, something that I would have never wanted someone not to have those things clear and concise. Now, on the other hand, Trump's rallies were frequently non-scripted, were frequently not always on message. He did always have certain three or four key messages that he hit, but he didn't hit them all the time. But he was very engaging and very performative. And if you think about the most extreme example of that is when he had a rally and where he said, well, let's just dance today. And they performed and he danced to YMCA. Okay. For I think it was something in the neighborhood of 45 minutes or something about like that. Very performative. Very much, I am the people. I am one of you. Not a lot of facts, not a lot of, well, not very many facts at all. But I'm not saying do that. But I am saying it's something that we need to learn from, which is how do we tap into that sense of the people's rhythm, the people's sense where their energy is. And I think that that's, we're going to get into that more and more when we talk about getting out there and listening to people. What do they want to hear? Not to give up your values with just what they want to hear, but understanding where they are psychologically, financially, socially, mentally. Doing that and being having our values be reflective of that. Now, the third part of that is doing that takes a lot of work and it can be exhausting. And also you can sometimes feel as though, is this really me? And am I performing or am I being true to my values? I can't give you a perfect answer to that. Because there is a performance element to politics, and it has become even more prevalent today. However, I would suggest strongly that you ask yourself, in my heart, do I believe that I will be doing good with this proposal, this reflective value of my constituency? And then you got to say to yourself, I have to shut myself down sometimes. So, you know, you find that and then you put that away and you do compartmentalize a little bit. And then you say, okay, now I just need time away. And that's when I suggest the way you get away from it, turn off your social media, give yourself, I don't know, I can't determine your time, give yourself an hour, 2 hours a day. Where you just say, I'm not consuming anything other than something that nourishes me and that fills me up. So those would be the aspects I talk about, I'd really think about. Understand that it is changing and that it has become more performative.
Yeah.
Understanding that you have to really be listening mentally and also really trying to get a sense of where people are psychologically in their heads. And the psychographics of that audience. And then thirdly, try to align it as much as possible, but protect yourself.
Thanks.
I already love this term that you're using, performative authenticity, because it feels like, it feels a bit paradoxical in a way.
Yes.
But it also feels very much like this is what we're up against. So I, Pam, maybe just to continue unpacking a bit, and you've spoken a little bit about it already in your third point around the individual adjusting to the circumstance. I want to just situate this conversation in the political arena that we're in at the moment. So we know that whether people are listening to this conversation in a week from us having it, or maybe 2 or 3 years from us having it, President Donald Trump has just taken up his second term as president. He's joined essentially in the office by a billionaire, Elon Musk, that has thrown, to put it mildly, a whole lot of curveballs into how American government works and whether it can do its job. And then we've just seen this weekend the German election and the Liberal Party not getting to the 5% minimum threshold that they needed to get back into parliament, and the far-right party becoming the second biggest party in Germany. We see the United States essentially sidelining Europe as they engage directly with Russia and deny that Russia is the aggressor of a war against Ukraine, and sidelining Ukrainian President Zelensky. And we see a very, very fragile ceasefire between Palestine and Israel, and a very complex, to put it mildly, Middle Eastern situation still. So if we think about the political arena and the state of liberal, freedom-orientated, democracy-orientated, human rights-orientated, progressive politics, I would not say that we're in the winning position, to put it mildly. And so I guess the risk is there that leaders in these types of organizations feel like they now need to compromise more than ever to win votes, to survive, to continue being elected, because clearly the electorate is wanting something that they're not getting from them. Other than staying in touch with yourself, and you mentioned such a beautiful, you know, almost like a little self-check where you ask in your heart of hearts whether this is good for your constituency and you take time out, etc. But what else can leaders do at this time when they're facing compromise or the anticipation of compromise in such a real way? And I would add something to that, where it's really about the survival of not just their organizations, but perhaps even of democracy itself.
No. Yes, it is a complete shift, what we're seeing and what we've seen. And it's a tidal change. And it did start quite a while back. And so that we saw these sort of movements, populist movement, far right, that sort of situation. And my first thought about this is that the perceptions, and why are these things happening? So what I believe has to happen, or we need to start thinking about, which is, what are people's perceptions, or what have there been perceptions of democracy or left-leaning governments? So to unpack that a little bit, what I mean is that this tidal change, or this change, has not been slow. It's not been fast. It's been slowly coming. It's very rapid in the last 3 months, but it has been coming for a while. And from what I see, and from what I, when I speak to my colleagues and other researchers, is this is what we're seeing around the world, is a response to what people's perceptions are of previous left-leaning governments, that they were unresponsive, technocrats, and they were overreaching. And so you've got this sudden, gosh, attack against it. Literally, that's what you're seeing, is an attack against what people see as unresponsive, overreaching, technocratic, also known as democracy. And that's how they perceive it. So as leaders, what I believe has to happen is we have to shift our thoughts around what does responsive look like, what does overreaching look like, and what does technocrats look like. If you just look at it from the standpoint of you gave so many different examples. There's Germany, but there's also, I'll go back to the United States and 2024, or 2025, what we've got right now is we've got an example of Elon Musk in office who's come in, and he is known as a disruptor. Now, a disruptor is a concept that they use in the area in a technical area in Silicon Valley, which you bring in a disruptor to break something up, to change things completely. And so we've got this difference between people perceiving the certain right wing or certain people leaning in that side as being disruptive and getting rid of old systems, and then the left being non-responsive, overreaching, and they're technocrats. They just concentrate on all of the technical part of it. So what does that mean for us? And what that means is that we have to think about what does responsive really look like? What does not overreaching look like? What is a technocrat? And I'm going to deal with the first two and let you all ponder on the technocrat, because I think that's different for every situation and for every organization. But I'll give another example. And this is actually what I saw in, once again, in the 2024 Harris-Trump campaign, which is you take the issue of immigration. The issue of, people coming into, the immigrants coming into the country. Okay, so immigrants coming in who are not, they're not legal. So what you got is that you got the Harris campaign talking about, oh, hey, we want to solve this problem. And you got the Trump campaign saying, we know how to solve this problem. We're down there. We're on the border. We're talking to people. We got all of our people out there talking to people. And actually, the Harris campaign, they really didn't respond to it in a timely manner. They weren't down there at the border. They weren't performing. They weren't being performative. They weren't showing that, hey, they were responsive. They were there. They were really making sure that they did what they needed to do. And that's where perception came in. And so this is where, as democracy finds its ground again, because it's on shaky ground, has to look at, what are the perceptions of democracy? What are the perceptions of my party? And talk to people about those perceptions. And then think about what are the strategies and the tactics that I am going to, are my political parties going to employ so that the perceptions of us change? Because right now the perception is non-responsive, takes too long, you've got too many regulations, just get rid of it all, disrupt it. Mm. Now, on the other hand, that's going to backfire a lot of ways, and we're already seeing it happening. It's happening in the United States, and it's happening in other countries. I know it's also happening here in Canada, where people are saying, hey, no, I don't want this disruptors. So I want everybody to recognize that this is also an opportunity, because as these disruptors happen, just like we're seeing in Germany, and there are going to be more disruptors, look for those opportunities to start and reconnect with people, with your base, with the people you know that you're going to, that want to be there with you. And those undecided, those ones who may have mixed perceptions about you or about your political party, How do you align what your values are and make sure that those values are perceived properly? And that is, first of all, as I say, by understanding better what they are. What does responsive mean to them? Being on the grassroots, being out there, being down there with them. And I keep hitting this, truly listening to what are people saying. And I think that for the last however many years, I would say for the last 8 years, truly, I don't know that people have really been listening and hearing left-leaning parties or democracy ideas. They're not hearing them. They're not hearing the value of it. And I don't want to go on too long about this, but I just want to talk about something very quickly. Is when I say listen to people, I want to break it down even further. I want you to listen to people in the way in which you think about how are their needs being met? That's the question. So when we look at something, there's something called Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Basically, that says, and I'm sure many of you are familiar with it, but basically the hierarchy of needs says that once people's basic needs get fulfilled, then they can think about things like democracy and, you know, how to make the world a more wonderful place. But when they're not getting their basic needs met and they feel like you're unresponsive to those needs, then they can't think about democracy. And so that when I just want to be clear about when I say unresponsive, that the unresponsive and the overreaching has to do with people feeling like their needs weren't getting met and nobody was paying any attention.
Mm.
So I hope that answers the question. It was a fairly long-winded answer to that question, but it's a complex question. And Does that clarify what we need to do?
I think there's so much depth and richness in that response. You know, what comes up for me as I listen to you is how we're having a conversation about public speaking skills in political leadership, but actually it's not about public speaking skills anymore. We're not operating in that time anymore where you had the luxury of learning the three things to be a better public speaker. And I do want to give our listeners who maybe are now, you know, they're out there, they're activists, they are elected political officials, they are doing their thing. So let's say you've encouraged them now to go find out, you know, what is it that that their constituents really need, what is at stake for them, and to go and be with them at grassroots level and to really listen. So they're doing all of these things. And then they come up against some, in their view, deeply problematic views that they really don't like. Whether it is, I mean, there's so many issues, whether it is about immigration or anything else, and they just think, oh, this is not a great view to have. What practical things would you say to a communicator? How do you engage with somebody in your audience that you disagree with or dislike even, but that you still would like them to, at some point in the future, perhaps consider supporting you, and you still want to connect with them on some level? What can you do in that moment?
All right. I have to address the first point, which is there are some people you are never going to convince or get them to see your perspective because it goes against their personal values, and it creates something that we call the dissonance, which means that it goes against the music or their vibrations of their life, of how they feel. So let's just put that out on the table. There are some you're not going to ever, ever reach and that are going to be aggressive and difficult. So let's just put those aside because it's not going to happen. As far as the other side, for those who don't share the same values or you don't share the same belief system, I would suggest that one, you try to determine by asking questions, depending on the forum that you're in, depending on the situation that you're in, by asking questions to them that can help you get a better idea of why they feel the way they feel. What's driving that belief system? So that potentially, if you can better understand what is driving that belief system, you can then make the decision about how you respond to that. And I want to give an example. So let's just use immigration for me, for example. So I will, as an immigrant to Canada and originally a U.S. citizen, I can be that in that situation. So I feel very strongly about immigration. I believe immigration and diversity is immense value and critical to any society. So those are my core beliefs. Diversity and immigration, changing things. And someone who I'm trying to talk to, they really don't believe that. They believe that diversity should not be involved in any hiring decisions, political decisions, things like that. They don't believe that people necessarily should come in. First, I've got to find out what is the real core reason why, or as much as I possibly can, why they feel the way they feel. And potentially, as I was saying, if I can understand why they feel the way they may feel, I can see it from their perspective and also address it from their perspective. And here's the example that I'll give for immigration. So many people here, I'll use Canada as an example, not the U.S. Many people here in Canada, even because we've just cut down on our immigration, the number of people that are going to be coming in. It was quite high post-pandemic, pre-pandemic, during the pandemic, and just recently there has been a total cut, basically in half of what are going to be the immigrants that come into Canada. Now, the reason for this is that people were getting upset about it. People were getting upset for reasons that no one was really clear about. But then suddenly what happened was is that there were a couple of politicians that went out and started talking to people and what their perceptions were. And then they went back to certain governmental organizations and also the parliament and started talking about what the issues were, which the issues were really quite relevant and quite reasonable, which is the healthcare system, we're overworked. The healthcare system can't take care of everybody. Housing is over. We don't have enough housing here. So people's perceptions were that these immigrants were coming in, taking their spots in healthcare, and they were taking their homes. Now, some of that has validity. But some of it doesn't. But the key is to understand why. So they disagree with you and someone says, I don't want immigrants here. And I think, no, I'm upset about it. I'm like, immigration is great. Diversity is great. It's all really good. But I don't understand why they don't want immigrants there. I need to understand that. And then I can either get out there and start to get my message out, repeat it, that immigrants are not, that what are the numbers that of what they are, of what they actually are using for housing? What are the numbers that they are using for the healthcare system? What is happening? And remember that I will have to repeat it, especially if these people don't agree with me, hundreds of times, not once or twice or two or three or four. It's changed. Mm-hmm. So Now, to the last point of, if it really just goes against everything you believe, I don't know how I can encourage someone to say, to embrace something. And maybe that's why I've never run for political office. I don't know. Because there are certain things that are just hard for me. But I admire everyone who does. And actually, I've thought in these last few months of throwing my hat into the political arena. I don't see it happening, but I have thought about it. So I hope that answers the question.
I think for what comes up for me is it touches on a very compelling case that was made by Ezra Klein and this MSNBC reporter, I think, or anchor, Chris Hayes, on the Ezra Klein Show, the podcast. We'll link it in the show notes for this one. It was an episode about attention and how Democrats in America are losing the attention war. Now, they situate it specifically in that context, but they make a very compelling case that attention is the number one currency. If you want to win political campaigns, you have to be able to grab people's attention. And to your point just now, I mean, we go to immigration because it is such a hot button topic, because people immediately are fixated by it. You have an opinion about it. And so you just need to bring up immigration and immediately you have people's attention. And their brains are fixated on this and defending their position, making their point, da 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 da. So in this climate of attention being the thing that we're seeking, and what I perceive in the world as, I wouldn't even call it populist approaches, mm-hmm. because I think we're past that point. It's almost like a sensationalism. A deliberate provoking that is used primarily from the far right to provoke anger, to provoke response. Because if they have your response, they have your attention. And if they have your attention, they can convince you. At least people are talking about it. And then the message gets out there. I mean, this is equivalent to like the AfD in Germany issuing those flight tickets for foreigners with their party branding on it, clearly sending a message that if they're coming in, foreigners are going to be, you know, booted out, which is the same message, but there's a gimmick attached to it that now gets people's response. I feel like we are so caught up in response mode in this attention world, and that those political leaders who have managed to master the art of grabbing attention while staying true to what they're trying to achieve are the ones that eventually get the headlines and get the power. And then what we see on the other side is that those parties who are more center, center left, the freedom loving parties, the liberal, the more traditional liberal parties are often moderate. They are more scientific in their approach. They are convinced by facts, so they think other people are convinced by facts, or at least they think they are. There's a more timid approach to political conversation. Sorry, I don't want to impede on your time, but if you'll hear me out, blah, 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 and meanwhile the other side just comes in, bam, here's a dead cat on the table, let's talk about the dead cat. So from a political communications perspective, if we step out of those tactics a little bit, what are your thoughts in terms of encouraging the organizations and political parties who stand for democracy, who stand for human rights, who stand for those liberal values? How would they break through this noise and grab people's attention without stooping to that level of the sensationalist approach that I think is perhaps not authentic to their message? Or or are those tactics fair game? Should we be doing that?
Excuse me.
So
things have changed. So I appreciate where you're coming from this, that standpoint, which it doesn't feel, it may be, I go back to performative. It feels like, oh, just an act, just an act. This is just what they do. You know, just like what you're saying. But what we have to understand is based on scientific research. So I'm going to give you this little fact. So there's a study that was done by the Wall Street Journal and also the University of Irvine, California, two very well-renowned organizations. And they both were looking at attention span. And the particular researcher is a woman by the name of Gloria Marks. And what she did was she looked at attention span in 2010, and they tracked it from 2010 to 2023. And what the research shows, and this was done with several other different large universities throughout the U.S. and around the world. So what they did was, you know, they basically said, okay, how long are people paying attention? And what the research has shown since 2002 to 2023, people's attention span has gone from 2 minutes to 47 seconds. This is the research. These are the facts. These things have been impacted by things like our smartphones. It is impacted by Instagram. It is impacted by all the social media. So we have to face that fact. So that means that we have to adjust. I'm not saying throw your facts, your scientific facts, your concrete facts out the window, but I am saying that you have to think about how you are going to present them in a way that is faster and more engaging. And one of the best ways to do that is to be able to have a statistic or a fact and add a story to it. Because stories are what people are seeing all the time now. They see, whether it's that boarding pass that you were talking about, Clinton, that creates an image, a visual, a story in people's head. Ooh, boarding pass, political party, immigrants out. That's a short story. Even though they didn't say this story, that is the story. So whether it be the visuals that you use, because visuals are also what is so important these days now, too, because people look at visual, their attention spans are so short that they're drawn to visual imagery even more than we have been in the past. So that means whether, as I say, whether you're, that your physical marketing is something like the boarding pass, or whether it is when you are speaking or talking or you are engaging with people, you have a statistic, but you also have a little story with it. Something that illustrates it, something that is, that may be a bit more dramatic than you've been accustomed to using. But these are the world, these are the real world things that we live, that we're living with today. And the fact is that, as I said, from 2 minutes to 47 seconds. So therefore, we short time to get them, and they want something that's going to get their attention. And so basically, as I said, you can take that concrete information, that statistic, that fact, and you combine it with a short snippet, a vignette, a picture, an image. I'll give you a quick example. So let's say I'm talking about, and I'm going to take, I'm a political fundraiser, or I know it is breast cancer research is something that as a woman politician, I am really committed to. And I want to create policies where there is more money being given to breast cancer research. So if I'm going to talk about that, I have to face the fact that I got to get to people fast. So I might use, and this is not an actual fact, everybody. So I'm just making this up. It's just an illustration. So I might say, BC Cancer Foundation, the Cancer Foundation of Canada, has found that one in every 20 women in our country will develop some form of breast cancer. Now, who is that going to be? Is that going to be me? Is that going to be you? Is that going to be your mother? Is that going to be your daughter? Your sister? Your grandmother? Who's that going to be? because it's going to be someone. So therefore, so right there, I've actually got a statistic that I put together, and I have a little story, which is a little bit sensationalism, but it gets people's attention because it's suddenly saying, ah, so it could happen to me. It could happen to my family. It could happen to my mom. Mm. That's a very simple, simple, straightforward example. And obviously, you want to be able to use your own and find facts and stories out. And also, you know, get anecdotal information from the people that you talk to. Mm. Find out what they're saying. Use those stories. Use those combined with a fact. And keep it short. What I just said was probably 20 seconds. Hopefully it wasn't any more than that. So the fact is we have to adjust.
Mm.
Since the latest research has shown, so the latest research, that same sort of research, and this one was actually from, this was the New York Times. And since the pandemic, our brains had actually physiologically changed. So pre-pandemic, when we were doing tasks, you know, we've called it multitasking. There is no multitasking. You can either do one thing or the other thing. But, you know, we usually would multitask two or three things, a couple of things. That's what people multitask. You do one thing, you do another thing. It's the pandemic when people started working it from home and having to juggle both work, home, family, everything. Our brains have gone from having one or two things they're thinking about to becoming like a computer browser. So people, think about it like tabs.
Mm.
Tabs on a computer. Used to, pre-pandemic, people had two or three tabs open on your computer. Now you've got 10.
More like 20 versus 200
More like 20. And people can go to any of those tabs at any point in time. So you have to understand our brains are browsers now. And that's why we have to have those smaller snippets, and they have to have a certain amount of sensationalism to them or drama.
Yeah.
But still be based in, but I want them to still be based in facts. Your illustrations, I want them to be more performative.
Yeah, it's the delivery of it, the package of it. Yeah.
I want to make it really practical now, and maybe quite individual to those who are listening to us. Let's say you are now standing, you're on a stage, you're about to speak, or you're in a town hall meeting about to address your audience, or you're on a podcast and you want to come across as amazing, engaging, compelling, or your team is encouraging you to make more videos for social media or whatever it is, but you struggle with nerves and you just really, really battle to calm your nervous system in that moment. And it leaves you feeling like you were the least eloquent, convincing person in the room, and everything that came out of your mouth was complete nonsense, and you just feel like you're not succeeding. What can you do?
Okay. So a couple of things that I want to address right away, which is I want to address the different situations that you might be in. I want to address a situation where you might be in a meeting speaking, or they want you to do more meetings or talk more or get out there more, do more grassroots, and you just have a hard time with it. So that's one situation where it's in person. And then there is something where, like you said, where they want you to do more videos, they want you to do more Instagrams, and you just feel really uncomfortable about it. In both situations, the fact is that the practical reality is that you have to keep doing it. Because the more you do it, the more you're going to be good at it and the better you're going to get at it. So that's the first step that I have to tell you. I know you're going to feel uncomfortable, and acknowledge that you are going to feel uncomfortable, and that is okay. But know that our bodies, and I go back to my scientific and my biology background, our bodies learn to do tasks and learn to do different things. And our bodies, the first time you do a video, it's going to be hard because your body doesn't know how to do it. Mm-hmm. You don't have what we call the neural pathways for it. Mm-hmm. Think about simple tasks that you do, like maybe driving, riding a bicycle, cooking something, fixing something. You didn't just know how to do that. You didn't get behind the wheel of a car and say, oh, I'm going to drive with stick now, a stick shift. It's going to be great. No, you had to learn how to drive a stick shift. So I can understand you are going to be uncomfortable because our bodies are being put in situations that they don't know. And when our bodies are in those situations, they respond physiologically and mentally. Mm-hmm. So the first step is, in both situations, breath. It's really, really breath. And there's something that you can do, which is called, it's deep diaphragmatic breathing, but an easier way to say it is that it's breathe, hold your breath, breathe. So basically, you inhale for, say, 6 counts. You hold your breath for 4 counts. And then you exhale for 8 counts. Always make the exhalation longer than the inhalation breath, because the exhalation breath is what calms your central nervous system and starts to reduce your fear and anxiety. And it decreases what I call your overstimulation.
Mm.
So when we have difficult tasks to do, our bodies get very, as I said, they get very stimulated. So our breath helps us to calm down. It helps us to relax. And the second thing, as I said, continue to do it again and again and again. So you build neural pathways for it. The third thing is that review yourself, record yourself and review yourself.
Mm.
And because it's going to be one of the best ways you can start to improve, see what you do well, and develop your skills. So those are a few things right there, which is breath, recording yourself, understanding that you need to practice to build neural pathways.
Mm.
Now, that's in creating something like a video or speaking in any situation. I want to address a situation where you are speaking to an audience, perhaps, and someone asks you a difficult question and you want to be able to respond, but you find that once they ask that question, you start to get overstimulated. Your heart starts to beat really fast. You feel like your hands are shaking. You're starting to perspire. All of those things, they are happening to you. So this is reality. What's happened is that your body is trying to protect you. So someone says something really nasty to you. Someone says to me, Pamela, well, I think you're stupid. And these are stupid ideas. My brain says, wait a minute, someone just attacked me. So my body's going to respond by getting me stimulated. It's going to increase my adrenaline. It's going to increase my cortisol. It's going to increase my all of my physiological things. Like, it's going to increase the blood pumping to my heart. So once again, that's where the breath comes in. So when you have those situations, the first thing you have to remember is that you need to take a moment. So someone says that, they say, you're stupid, I think you're an idiot. And my body wants to say, hey, I'm going to punch you out. But my brain says, stop, there's a stimulus. Breathe. Think. Respond. Stimulus. Breath. Think, respond. Now, the fact is that when you first start, that starts happening to you, it's going to take you a while to stop, not over respond to that stimulus, that attack.
Mm.
But when you do it again and again and again, and you have that breath, the stimulus happens, your brain says, oh my God, I've been attacked. Your body starts to respond. You have a breath. And your brain then says, okay, wait a minute. That wasn't an attack that's going to kill me. That's just a verbal attack. So respond appropriately, as opposed to the other response, which is, they attacked me. I can't breathe. I'm going to stop breathing. And now I'm just going to yell and I'm going to be screaming. I'm going to be upset. Can't do anything with that.
Mm-hmm.
Breath. Stimulus, breath, breath, think, respond.
Mm. Thank you, Ben.
And so those two things, recognize that it's going to be uncomfortable when you start to do things that you haven't done before and that you don't do very often. It will become less uncomfortable over time as your body begins to generalize and understands how to do this and that it's not going to be a danger to it.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing is that your breath and respond to stimulus. Your breath is your friend.
Yeah. There's something almost poetic about having gone almost full circle in this conversation, starting off with how much the landscape within which we communicate has changed. How much has changed, and yet at the end, realizing that the key to our ability to stand within that change is something that has remained unchanged in a way. The biology of breathing, of creating space for yourself so that you can think, so that you can decide what your response is instead of being thrown into your response the whole time. There's almost something soothing about knowing that the key to that lies within us, and that it is something that we can practice. It is open to us. It might feel, it might feel strange and awkward, but it is a skill we can develop. It's not just something that you're born with or not. You can develop those neural pathways, as you said.
Exactly. And it's absolutely right, Clinton. And the fact is that it is a skill.
Mm.
It is not rocket science. You know, it is truly a skill that you learn and that you develop. And that I love that when you were saying recognizing how our bodies respond. And our bodies respond, as I said, to what it perceives as danger or something that might be of harm. And the more you do something, the more your body says, well, yeah, this is something that's a little challenging and I need stimulation, but I'm not going to die.
Yeah.
It's not going to kill me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, here's the thing. I'm afraid to do this thing. So let me do it afraid.
That's right.
Let me return to myself, recognize that this is a biological response I'm having. And here is how I would like to choose to proceed with it through it.
Yes.
So that it becomes easier.
Yes. Yes.
Pam, to bring the conversation to a close, and for someone who is interested in developing this skill further, I'm sure you must have a whole library of books and resources and podcasts and people. But are there a few, or are there any books or podcasts that perhaps come to mind for you now that people could consider on this particular topic that you could recommend?
Yes, actually, there are a few things that I recommend. One of the things that I strongly recommend is I recommend picking a particular topic and going to TED Talks. This is one of my favorite things to do there are a couple people that I think are really great. There's a gentleman by the name of Julian Treasure who talks about listening and how to be a better listener,
mm-hmm.
which I think is a very underrated tool. Mm-hmm. I love what he talks about and how we are. And he also talks about how we're losing our listening in this world that we live in with all of this attention grabbing and things like that. So he's great to listen to, so you can get some really good stuff from things like that. I also suggest that you look at, I personally think that Michelle Obama's book, Becoming, is a great book to read, especially for women and women on journeys and looking at challenges and things that she faced. It's a very readable book, and I found it very inspiring in that regard. So I think that's quite good. There is a gentleman by the name of And he does this more for meetings, but I do think it's interesting because his name is Chad Littlefield. And I can send this to you too. His name is Chad Littlefield, and he deals more with connection and how to connect with people. But I think it's a very underused tool that he has. So he's got tons of podcasts, and sometimes it's for meetings and things like that, but other times it's just connecting with people in general. And as we look at that aspect of doing the grassroots, getting in touch with people, how do you connect with people? So those are some that I would think right away. And I'm just going to reach down here because it came to me earlier today. Here is this a book that I really love. It's called Life Scripts. And it's one that says what to say to get what you want in life's toughest situations. Now, I quite like the book because it gives you situations to live in. And I like books like that with scripts because they help us to imagine how we will respond in situations and also potentially rehearse for how we'll respond in situations, which means we'll respond more effectively when we're in those situations. So those are just a few that I would say would be some to take a look at. And yeah, those would be a few I would say to take a look at. And I just want to leave with one particular thing.
Yeah.
As far as when people, I want you to understand, everyone, that when you think about what you may perceive as fear or anxiety or that heart racing or your hands feeling clammy or sweaty or any of those feelings that you have, recognize that your body is stimulated because it needs to respond to something. Now, stimulation is good. We don't want to not be stimulated. What we want is we just don't want to be crazy stimulated. So when you think about it like this, and this is the last thing I want to leave you with, is that when we think about as far as performance and how people perform the best, and whether it be in athletics, whether it be speaking or whatever, when you're at a resting state, you're at a stimulus of about 1 to 3 or 4, just sort of a resting state. When you're excited about something and you're at a high performance state, it's about I would say 5, 6, 7. And that's a great spot to be where you feel like you've got energy, you're ready to go, you're ready to do that thing. Now, what can happen is we become overstimulated, and that's where we get to be at 8, 9, or 10, and our heart's racing, we can't think any of those things. Stimulus is good, just overstimulus isn't good. So remember the breath, because it can take you to that medium space of where you're powerful, engaging, passionate, and authentic. And that's a beautiful thing.
That seems like an appropriately passionate and encouraging point to end this conversation. I want to thank you and appreciate you, Pam, for joining us. I know it's also very early on your side of the world. Thank you very much for joining us for this conversation. It's been a pleasure to learn from you and to talk with you about something that I see is also lies very close to your heart. So thank you for making the time and joining
us. My pleasure. I'm so happy to see you both again, and hopefully in the coming years, we'll get together in person again.
That would be amazing. Thanks, Pam.
Wonderful.
This episode forms part of the IAF podcast series that accompanies regular seminar programs of the International Academy for Leadership in Gummersbach, Germany. Feel free to listen to our other episodes and share your thoughts in response, and to keep an eye on the work of the IAF on its various social media channels. Until next time.
Bye.
Bye.